Hey guys!
Hello!
And welcome to Let's Get Freaky Podcast Episode 2.
Episode 2.
Look at us, Episode 2.
Woohoo!
Wow!
Making moves.
Thank you so much to everyone who listened to Episode 1. We're not going to do this every week, by the way, say Episode 1, Episode 2. It's just for the first
few. Might do. Episode 100.
We are going to be putting the show out every week, so, you know, that could get a bit tedious after a while. So
tedious.
That's a strong word for me, eh?
That was a big word.
Thank you so much to everyone who's got back to us from last week's show.
Yeah, thank you to everyone really who took the time to listen.
Before we say anything else.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Have you had any premonitions this week in your dream? That was one of the big feedbacks that we got.
You are horrible, man. No, I'm just putting it out there.
Because we all heard it.
We all heard it. You forgot the word too.
Yeah, we both forgot the word. It happens. We're only human. But we know it now, right?
We knew the word before. We just had so much going for our minds.
Premonition. So have you had any premonitions?
Not recently, no. I'm not crazy.
Well.
I have had premonitions before, like I said.
Yeah.
But they're not paranormal premonitions. They're just things I've dreamt about and have come true.
Well, that is paranormal.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is. If you've dreamt about something before it's happened and it happens, that's pretty freaky. Oh, and that could be seen as a lot of things.
Well, just make sure you pour a shot and have one every time you say the word premonition.
Are we making a Let's Get Freaky drinking game?
Yeah. It will get freaky. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Okay, so I'm not talking about my premonitions.
I think you should. Just give us one. If you've got more, I think we should hear it.
No, they're not. No one wants to hear about
them. Of course they do.
We'll do a whole premonition show. Premonition show. We'll do a whole premonition show.
A whole show on people that have had crazy dreams.
Crazy dreams. You've dreamt about something that's come real. Get in touch. Let us know.
If you've ever had a crazy dream or any premonitions in your dream, get in touch with us. You can reach us on social media. TC Let's Get Freaky Podcast on Instagram, Twitter, and we're also on Facebook. You can also email us Let's Get Freaky Podcast at outlook.com. We'd love to hear from you and we'd love to have you on the show. Crazy dreams, any crazy experiences, we want to hear from you.
Yeah, and it'll make me not feel so crazy because I feel like I'm the only one who has crazy dreams. So
I think it's quite a common thing, to be
honest. Let me know that I'm not on my own. And if you forget any words, don't worry because I'm here.
As long as you're not recording it, it's fine.
It doesn't matter.
It really doesn't, no. There's no pressure here.
No pressure.
So I also got some good feedback. I got a lot of people.
Oh, did you?
I didn't realise how many
all about you, is it?
Ghostly experience that I've had. I also forgot some.
Oh, gosh.
I know we didn't write anything down or anything. We just sort of spoke about it. But even my dad rang me up and was like, I can't believe you didn't talk about the Devon stuff. And I was like, oh, Dad.
Devon?
You're going to have to come on and talk about that with me.
Oh, yeah. That would be interesting. On.
Yeah.
Come
that
on,
would
Malcolm.
Be a great show. But, so there's a lot more that we could go into, and we will go into the Devon stuff. To be honest, we could do a whole show on it. It's pretty crazy. It's more involving my family than me, but yeah, I'd love to get into that soon. So that'll be good.
I don't think I know about what's happened in Devon. I've never been to Devon.
What happens in Devon stays in Devon.
Oh, no.
Until it comes on Let's Get Freaky
I'm not
podcast.
Listening to that one.
So today's show is a great one. It's a really good show.
Today's show is a different show.
Yeah, it's a good show. It's Andy McGrath, who is absolutely fantastic. He's an amazing guy. He has got over 25 years experience in cryptozoology.
Wow, cryptozoology.
So that is the studying of unknown creatures that have not been proven by science.
Right, okay.
So Loch Ness
we'll
Monster.
Let Andy tell everybody what
Bigfoot
that means.
And more. That's the great thing. There's more that we didn't even know about.
And can I just say, before you play his interview, how He's just such a genuine guy. He was just really nice. When we wasn't recording, he was just so laid back and chill and just chatting.
Yeah.
He was talking about our families. He's just really nice. So I just want everybody to listen to him, find him on the internet, buy his books.
Yeah, he's got some great books out. Beast of Britain, one of them that I've read, and it is absolutely amazing.
And it's also available on audiobook, I think he says, as well. So if you're like me and just want to lay in bed and chill or while you're doing the washing up and just listen, you can do that.
He does say that. I think at the end of the show, he does say where you can find his book and stuff. I'd certainly recommend it myself.
So just get ready for a real knowledgeable...
Enjoy, guys.
...show.
Let's get freaky. Okay, guys, tonight we are joined by Andy McGrath. Thank you, sir, for joining us. How are you?
I'm good. I'm on the back of a big family weekend, Queen's Jubilee, you know.
Lovely.
I feel about as tired as she does at the moment, Madge. You know, I've got that 97-year-old sort of fatigue on, but I'm good to go.
Yeah, good stuff. Now, I first heard you on Sasquatch Chronicles.
Yeah.
And I was fascinated.
Yeah.
So could you just tell us a little bit about what you do?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I just self-described cryptozoology enthusiast and an author and researcher, and I go on field expeditions as well, although not so many the last year and a bit, you know, because of the whole thing we won't mention.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's just, well, I've always loved cryptids since I was a teenager. So, you know, in the bio, it says 25 plus years experience and research, but that was in 2016. So, you know, it was kind of further on then. And I always collected little clippings from, you know, from magazines, or if there was a Nessie sighting or a Bigfoot sighting somewhere in the US, I just collected it when, you know, there was no computers to save these things. And then, you know, entered into that whole chat room era, people talking crazy stuff about cryptids. You know, negotiated that minefield.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Facebook, YouTube, all that stuff came along, and there was these great mediums to exchange information and get information. And you just followed along. You know, that was my whole life. I was a musician, a singer for years and years, touring and playing, and came to London 2009, met a wonderful lady, got married 2010. Started to work in the Big Smoke, and you know, 50-hour weeks, 3-hour commute, the standard easy London life.
Yeah.
And in 2016, we both just said, like, wow, you know, we've been working for ages and we had a little money saved. Why don't we do like a little project and take some time off? Like a year, that was the plan, like a year. And she decided to do her psychotherapy and everything that she's been doing. And she said, I didn't know what to do. And I was kind of done with the music, you know, kind of that flattened out. I was tired with that. She said, what about this monster thing you're always talking about? And like, or monsters. And I said, oh, okay. Well, maybe I'll write a TV series because I'm stupid. I don't realize that there's a mountain in front of me. I was like, why don't I climb that thing? And in my flip-flops. And I tried to pitch it as a TV thing. And a friend of mine who was in TV said, well, look, listen, somebody's just going to take that. They'll steal it right off you. Write a book, come up with like a little title, and then publish a book, then try to sell the series. And then they can't really take it. I said, oh, fair enough. And I thought, beasts around the world, beasts all over the place, beasts of this place. And I thought, well, just start with a country you know. And I had this American friend that was sort of teasing me, like, oh, what have you got? You just got Nessie in Britain. That's it. And they're done. I said, no, I'm going to prove him wrong and I've got to look into it and find even more things. And so Beast of Britain, it just kind of popped into my head. Oh, Beast of Britain, that's what we'll call it. And I started looking into sightings, lake monsters first, because that's my big love. And then I found these like Green Man, Woodwose, British Bigfoot sightings, things like that. werewolf sightings, modern day ones, even not like that's stuff amazing. From folklore and the past. I was like, yeah. like werewolf sightings, what the hell? Amazing. You know, black shook, little people, even yeah. things like weird flying cryptids like bad beasts and pterosaurs. I was like, this is insane. And what I found with a lot of the and of course the big cats and you know everything else that we it's easy to accept might be here because it's a creature we know about.
Yeah,
but it's just not supposed to be in our country. And I just started looking to it and talking to witnesses, first-hand witnesses as well as stories that were referred to me. And I was like astonished by how many of them were believable, to put it you know bluntly, you know, from a normie yeah. point of view. It's sort of we're looking at a sort of modern folklore, you know, folklore happening in real time in the modern day, but it's still sort of this weird folklore sort of thing.
Yeah.
And a lot of people said to me, oh, look, it's all paranormal. You know, Nessie is like this portal jumping thing. And Bigfoot is like a spirit and this one and that one and the other. And I just thought, no, they all sort of present like animals. Every presentation it seems to be like an animal presentation, even when it's a bit weird, like a werewolf type thing.
Yeah.
It's always got this animal like, characteristic. Just investigate them like they're animals and see how far you get. And
yeah.
then the book happened, you know, 2017, I published it. 2019, I looked at it and went, oh my God, this is terrible. You never wrote a book before. Quick, change that and fix it and blah. And then in 2021, I signed a publishing deal with Monster Quest, Doug Hychek's publishing company with his son Alex, called Hangar One Publishing, great publishing company, great books. Other books, I mean, not mine, but the great books. And they said, well, what about this piece of the world thing you're talking about now? Could you make that a book? I said, yeah, absolutely. But I want to fix this piece of Britain thing one last time and before I leave it for good. So I spent like 3 months in 2021 just going through every single section of the book, removed like 150 pages, stuck another sort of 200 and something in. So it's actually longer than the one previously, even though I took so much out. And then wrote Beast of the World, Volume 1, which initially was supposed to be just one book. And the research notes were 700 pages long. Wow. I was like, okay, well, you can't, like, you just can't do it. So you're going to have to split it up. And that's where I got the, I know I'm waxing lyrical here, but that's when I got the sections that, okay, that you can have these cryptids and those cryptids. You got seven books, about 350 pages each. So let's do it like that.
Wow.
And now I'm in the second book, like a fool, thinking I can do it before September.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's amazing. Well, this really is an incredible book. Oh, I was blown away by how many different cryptids there are in England.
Yeah, there's a few.
It's crazy.
A few.
Because I've always been fascinated with the subject. And obviously, so I was listening to podcasts in America because that's normally where you hear these sort of things. And then to find out that in Britain, we've got all these amazing cryptids as well. It's fascinating.
I mean, I used to be a big believer in it. I'm still a believer because I believe the witnesses, you know, so in that stage I'm a believer, but now I've got to this stage when I said, it's wrong for you to believe anymore, and you've just got to be taking the information, presenting it, and then sort of adding, like we did in the book there with the beastly theories, a few theories on what it might be, even theories you don't like very much, and stick those in there, and then it's for people to make up their own mind. It's not you for you to judge the witness, to judge the witness, because they've come to you with an open heart, shared something. So you can't say, oh, in the old days, I'd be on Interpol, you know, checking the person out.
Yeah.
Sort of looking at Facebook stuff and saying, do they seem insane and crazy? And, you know, have they done this before? Just because I'd been caught out so many times, you know, by some amazing, almost pathologically, you know, sociopathic cases. Yeah. I thought, wow, this person had me. I believe them 100%. Believe them. And yet, later, something's come up. I've caught them in a line. That's like shocked me almost.
Yeah,
I can't believe that. I was just so taken in.
That's the problem, because you get those people, isn't it? Because you get the people
who
lie and
attention. It's attention.
Yeah,
it's a weird attention. If you think of it, you're putting yourself in a really strange place.
Yeah,
it's not like positive attention, because nobody thanks you when you publicly, I mean, in the normie world, and he says, well done, you know, Tommy, you saw a Bigfoot. Oh, yeah. About that promotion you're going for. Yeah, well, you're the guy we selected. No, you're not the guy they selected anymore.
You know? Yeah, exactly.
Because you think you saw a Bigfoot and maybe you're a bit on the fringe, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it.
Well, I'm definitely a lot more open-minded to it now.
Yeah.
Definitely with all the things you listen to and you watch. And like you said, you don't know who to believe. You don't know who's lying. But there must be something into it. The amount of people that say they've seen something or heard something, there must be something there.
There's a lot of corroboration.
I would personally love imagine just having that experience.
That'd be amazing
to see something.
Have you ever seen anything, Andy? That's
no. I was in a forest in Scotland once by myself for about 4 hours in the winter, and I had a funny experience it was a funny psychological experience because I believed that I'd worked myself up, right? And it was good for me then to think, all right. There's a few things that came to mind. First of all, I was up above Loch Ness in the Great Glen Highway, and I was on part of it. It was like a sort of 4-hour trek. It was January, so there was no one around, just me. It wasn't snowing, but it was like cold. You know, it was all wrapped up. And the forest is really thick, sort of pine in places. It's just all dark. And as I was coming down on this big steep slope on the other side, I was sure that I saw like a figure, just the outline in the corner of my eye figure. Dad, go behind a tree. There's a dash behind the tree, and I looked up. So, hang on a second. Did I see something? And I started talking to myself and saying, Angela, you're a guy in the forest looking for Bigfoot who thinks he's seen a figure in the corner of his eye. Like, and then I had a bit of fear on me. And I thought, okay, there's about 2 hours to get down from this hike. And now suddenly you realize you're seeing the reality of the situation of an encounter.
Yeah,
if you are going to encounter something now. You're not going to get away. You're 2 hours away from, you know, from the bottom. And if it's a real creature, it's going to make a decision about you the same way you're going to make a decision about it. It's an individual. Like, you know, you meet a bear in the forest. It could eat you, lick you, pass you by, run away. You don't know what's going to happen. And it depends on the bear, right?
Yep.
So I'm thinking, okay, so this is your situation now. But as I sort of climb down further and further, I could hear all cracks and creaks and pops in the forest then. And there's red deer and all kinds of things up there. I probably heard them on the way up, but now I was shit up, you know. So, so I was coming down and, you know, nothing happened. And I got down to the bottom. And it just sort of reminded me, you know, sometimes when we think of having these big encounters, talking to people having activity all the time, I'm very dubious about that. I want activity to be like something. I saw a figure, a stick come flying out of the forest and smash me in the head. You know, like something happened that I can quantify as not being natural in some way of my own, you know, fear, which I definitely was feeling at that point. But yeah, I would like to have an encounter initially from a distance.
Yeah.
And, you know,
that would be amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, with binoculars or something like that.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking about, like you said, about big cats as well. And you said that does seem more maybe believable to the people who can be a bit skeptical. Well,
my mother-in-law has actually seen, as she says,
she was driving home when we was in Essex, and she was driving home with her sister. And they both at the same time saw something but didn't actually tell each other till they got home. And the other one said, I need to tell you something. It might sound a bit crazy. And then the other one said, did you see this big cat? And they both said, yes, they both saw this large black, which looked like a big cat
panther.
To them.
Yeah.
But they didn't say anything at the time because they thought it was so like outrageous almost.
Well, you think of that. That's with the big cat. They feel that way. What if it's like a Bigfoot? Who would you tell? And
yeah.
A lot of people, I think they don't talk because even people like me, the place I work, nobody knows if I do this because why would I put myself in that position? If they find out, that's fine. But essentially, if I go in and start Bigfoot talking and Big Ken talking, they're going to be like, oh, God, you know, something.
I'll get out of that.
Oh, no.
Yeah, you do. But, you know, it's just, it's a hobby and I don't need to go into it. And it's just a funny thing. With the big cats, there's at least an origination point. 1976, the Dangerous Wild Animals Act comes in, as you probably know. And within it, the stipulations on the kind of enclosures animals like big cats would have to have, you know, it was air conditioned, had a, you know, water source, had room to run around in, gigantic enclosures. And the people before were just keeping them on farms and in sheds, and pumas and panthers and all kinds of things. Those two mainly, but other cats too. And they let them go. Lots of people have been to let them go. That Lou Foley, he used to be the sort of lion man, you know, of in the Malvern Hills, he allegedly lets them go. The big zoo, the big zoo family, what are they called again? Chipperfield or Chippendale?
Okay.
I'll find a few. They, you know, she just let
them go.
She just let them go because she was given an order to get rid of them all and take them to the zoo. And there was three that she really, really liked, and they mysteriously disappeared in transit.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
And
that's crazy, isn't it?
We've got 30 million sheep, 30 million plus rabbits, there's millions of deer and everything. It's the land without predators, really.
Yeah.
And they could easily just slip away.
Yeah. Right?
And just, you know, inhabit their territory, live for about maybe 12 to 16 years in the wild, and have a few cubs, and on you go. And we'd be seeing their descendants now, not even the ones that were released.
Yeah.
These are like natural born, British born native big cats.
And do you think we have a large number of them, or?
I think there's a lot, but it depends what you mean by large, because they don't each need a large territory. So, you know, there were reports from where you guys are in Essex, right the way to the Highlands in Scotland.
Yeah.
So, let's say you give each cat like 20 to 30 miles each, you know, how many would you have? I'm saying that maybe they said 200. Is there a bit more than that? I don't know. Yeah.
It's fascinating, though, isn't it? It'd be
amazing
to see one in the wild.
again, at a distance. Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah,
but not kidding.
But there is a lot of reports of people seeing big cats, isn't there? There's a lot of, I see it on the news, on Facebook and things all the time, that stories of people seeing things, and so this is it's quite common that people see these things, isn't it?
It's very common. I mean, sometimes look, a lot of these things that people are seeing are savannah cats, you know, these serval domestic cat cross. Mm-hmm. They're very tall, they're spotted occasionally, and somebody sees one running about, you know, and says, oh my gosh, I've just seen a big cat. And it's not a big cat, but it's, you know, it's a large exotic breed, let's put it that way. Fair enough. But I've had so many people come to me and say, look, this is what I saw. And they're often very very confused about it. That's a story I always tell on here a lot about a horse breeder in Hampshire, not far from here. And she went to get a consignment of hay with a friend one night, November 2017. And at a local farm, one of these places where you just sort of drive in, you know, you've got a contract with them, subscription, you drive in, you pick up your hay and you leave. There's nobody there, essentially. And she drove in, she put the hay in a Land Rover, and they were coming down just to close the gate before they left. Her and a friend, in the lights of the car, they saw a large male panther. They said, saw it clearly, saw its genitalia and everything,
wow.
Really heavily muscled, about waist high. She was 5'8", this lady, about waist high. Big bone, she referred to it as, like a strong animal, just sauntering down towards them, licking its lips, sort of licking the face, you know, and got about 20 yards away and walked off into the bush.
It's amazing.
As easy as that. Not concerned by them, not even really even interested, you know. Walked by and off it went. And, you know, that just reminded me that these are all over the place. I first encountered this in 1999. I was staying in a place called Crymych in West Wales, near the Preseli Mountains. And I think it was New Year's or Christmas, one or the other. And staying at an ex-girlfriend's house with her parents. And they had people up from London, like friends, over. And one of the ladies there, heavy smoker. She'd come out onto the patio, and they were, I suppose, for context, their house was about 5 miles away from their neighbor, their closest neighbor. And she came onto the patio to have a cigarette about 5 in the morning. She couldn't smoke in the house. You know, heavy smoker, this lady, and lit up her cigarette. And there in the light, you know, sort of 10 feet away, was this large Black Panther staring at her.
Wow.
Yeah, and she just sort of froze and looked at it, and it turned around and walked away. Next morning, she told us, we all went, you know, off looking for it, you know, sort of excitedly, ah, yeah. Oh, it's a panther somewhere. And then the younger sister, the girl I was with, I confessed that she'd seen one, you know, a few months before, when riding back over the mountain from a friend's farm. She'd got to the top on her horse and looked down and seen this panther chasing sheep around, you know, in the field. And she was a very skeptical person. From that moment, I was like, oh my goodness, this is amazing. You know, are they big cats in Britain? It was like a shock to me. There are. They're everywhere.
Mad. Yeah.
They seem to be. It's,
especially when you hear it from someone that you know is not going to lie, or like your mum. We know your mum's not going to. It's not something and it's not something she really talks about. Like, I always bring it up to her. Is it a fascinating?
Didn't want to speak about it.
Yeah, but that's something.
Like, enough, Tommy. Enough. My friends aren't talking to me.
He's talking about
telling people on podcasts. I've seen something.
Can't take him anywhere.
I think I've heard you on another podcast talk about this, and I think you said, people don't report it. So how can you keep a record if you don't report it? Like, your mum didn't report it.
Yes.
No. So most people don't report it. What are you gonna say?
Yeah. It's like Andy just said as well. If my mum and my aunt was almost embarrassed to tell each other if they saw a cat.
That's crazy.
How, like he said, how if he saw something else, she would never think of reporting it because of the opinion and the judgmental character of everybody else. But I'm here just to listen. But now you're here, Andy. I would love to get your opinion on something that me and Tommy talk about a little bit. Is the Loch Ness, and just your kind of take on it and how you feel, because I feel like my mind is open to anything, but I would love to.
Yeah, sorry, I'm jumping in before you finish. Sorry.
No, go.
So rude. Just jumping in all over the place.
No,
you know, you'll say, what was he like? And he was like, well, you know, it's not that. It was a problem getting him off was the issue.
No, that's what he
won't
have his wife on here again.
No, not at all. Look, I think you know, the whole thing with the Loch Ness Monster to me is my opinion is not very popular, basically, because I think in many ways the descriptions say enough, you know, that people have. They describe this thing with a humpback, a long body, 4 flippers when they see it on land, long tail, long neck with a short head, a small head. And that seems to be like a plesiosaur-like description to me. In many cases, not only in Loch Ness, but Loch Morar, Loch Lochy, Loch Garry, and all these other places, or Lake Windermere, or around the coast of Britain, there's lots of sightings too. They mostly tend to fall into that kind of category. And there's all these excuses of, oh, you know, maybe it's this giant salamander we haven't found yet, or what did somebody say, a giant mud skipper with a plesiosaur neck and head like lure on its head. And I was like, well, that's a big lure, like, what's it catching in there, what's that for? Nobody thought of how big's the fish it's trying to get.
It's crazy and, how people accept that and not a Loch Ness. But
ghosts of dinosaurs, that's another popular one from a very popular researcher, who people like, oh yeah, you know, no, it's not that, it must be like ghosts from the past. You're like, that's plausible to you, but not that something could have survived.
That's more,
weird. Yeah. You know, it could be a seal, it could be a catfish, it could be a big eel, but then the very descriptive sightings, especially the land ones, they don't really match it. And so for me, I'm old school. I think it's, you know, like a surviving species of prehistoric, you know, reptile, basically aquatic reptile. And I think most, not all, but most of the worldwide sightings are the same thing.
Yeah. Because what's that famous one that was in What part of America was it? Where they caught a photo of it.
Lake Champlain.
Yeah, that's it.
Champ. Yeah, I've been there.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I went there. It's huge body of water. It's like 140 miles long, something like that. 40 miles wide at the widest. It's like a sea.
Okay.
You
know,
and when you compare it to something like Loch Ness, it's like 25 miles long. Like, yeah. Wow, okay, yeah, something yeah. could live in here.
Yeah.
And I met people there who'd seen it. I met a lot of people who've been researching it for years. In fact, a good friend of mine, Scott Mardis, who died last year, suddenly, he was a very well-known CHAMP researcher. You know, and he knew everything. He sent me so many, so much material, actually great material, about this creature that he'd accidentally seen on a trip there in the 90s. And he sort of just took him, and he had to stay, you know. Had to stay, and he went back every year, even when he left the area. Every single summer, he went back to look for this creature. And that's what happens. That's how it takes them, these researchers. Yeah. They have a sighting or something piques their interest, and then they can't leave.
Yeah.
You know, they're done they're forever, hooked. Basically. They're hooked. And it can be damaging, really damaging to your life, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe you don't work. You have to try and raise funds somehow. You know, it's different for me. I've always worked, or at least when I'm doing the crypto stuff, it's with savings, you know, that I've busted my hump for, you know. So, I don't think I could be one of those guys out there in the field every single day, unless there was some hefty sort of funding behind it.
Yeah.
And think like a Londoner, see, with the money.
it's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah,
I would love to spend my days looking for.
Be great.
Right here.
Oh. Yeah, it'd be fantastic. Yeah.
So I just had a message pop up on there. We'll ignore that.
Oh yeah. Okay.
So there was some other. There was some other amazing cryptids in the book, and the little people. I find that fascinating.
Yeah, yeah. I got some theories about that. I'm just gonna get my little file up so I don't get all the dates wrong and things. I always do that. So for me, the little people, I had these, and I talk about this in the new book as well, in the little section in Beasts of the World, the Hairy Humanoids, the new book. I just, you know, wondered, could it be a type of resurgent folklore that we're getting? Know about fairies and whatnot,
yeah.
Or could it be that they're sort of proto pygmies of a kind? Do you know what I mean? But that's sort of like an archaic type of diminutive human or humanoid from the past that's remained and existed. Yeah, because there's stories like this, like all over the world, actually, everywhere you go. There's stories of these little people. They got like you've got the Trolls in the Orkney Isles. You've got lots of different personalities here, little people personalities that people have seen. And first of all, I was like, are these diminutive sort of primates? Like, it's just like in Australia, you have the Yowie, which is the big sort of big ape man type creature, or I'd say more of a wild man. And then you have the Jenjardi or the Nimbinji, which is more of a sort of 1.5 meter tall primate-like little hairy creature that's referred to as a little foot sometimes. Yeah. So, you know, is that the kind of thing we're dealing with here? And if so, is it more of a species that's functionally extinct around the world? And by that I mean that they still exist, but in such small numbers.
Yeah.
They're not, what's the word? Not flourishing, you know, is that what we're looking at, you know? Or are we just in that stage now? You've got all these fairy whisperers, haven't you, out there, giving you tours everywhere. Are we just in the stage of resurgent folklore? Because, you know, the corporate religion is gone, and we're all looking for something to sort of fill it up again. And, you know, fairy lore is all sort of magical and interesting and takes you in. And, it, you know, it's got that promise in it of otherworldliness, hasn't it? So, are we just sort of pumping that up a bit in our imagination and pretending to see these things?
It is amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I would love to see something like that. That would be...
Yeah.
The other thing is the werewolves. the
yeah.
Dogman.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Dogman. I mean, scary.
Again,
I don't know if I'd want to see. Yeah.
Is it even possible? You know, and like biologically, you know, is it possible to have such a thing? Like the Bigfoot, you could argue, okay, maybe there's an upright form of ape. We've got that, things like Gigantopithecus and other archaic hominids that we can look to in the past and say, could one of these survived for Bigfoot, right?
Yeah.
But for the werewolf, what could that be? I did have a theory, and I talk about it in the new book as well as this one.
Yeah.
That you know, perhaps you know, what we're looking at is a type of extinct giant monkey. So, like Ron Coleman and Patrick Keig in their book, The Field Guide to Bigfoot and Other Mystery Primates, they talk about giant monkeys that are reported in Asia and the Americas, like Cardan and Beckbach and Salvachia and Isnashi. These sort of 4 to 6 foot tall giant monkeys with dog-like or baboon-like faces and pointed ears and dark piercing eyes. They often got the shaggy black or red hair, and they're very aggressive, said to be very aggressive. That seems to have a lot of parallels with the werewolf of old European folklore.
Yeah.
So, you know, my theory was, are they still surviving in those places in Asia and South America, in the thick jungles, but they're sort of, again, functionally extinct in Europe and North America. So people are occasionally seeing these specimens in ones and twos, like of a remnant population, but something that's, you know, on the verge of extinction, so to speak. You know, is it something else? Is it something more supernatural? And one of the things we find, and you probably read in the book, is about this cult-like ritual activity that existed in the past, even in ancient Greece and other places, and still exists in some cults today, in which, you know, either as a physical demonic manifestation brought forth in a person, or the person undergoes a trance-like or normally drug-induced metamorphosis where they believe they are a werewolf,
yeah,
and act as such, almost, you know, taking part in ritual sacrifice or attacking people and things like that. And there's, you probably remember in the book, there's the story that that Pliny the Elder told of the young athlete Demarcus, and it took taking place in this Arcadian sacrifice,
yeah,
of this adolescent boy, where after he tastes the entrails of the young boy, he's transformed into a wolf for 9 years. And there's stories like that all throughout history.
Yeah.
And I just wonder, yeah, is that the kind of thing that we're seeing here? Or
yeah,
again, this resurgent folklore, are we just bored again with the way things are? We're, you know, we're trying to bring something special and supernatural back into our lives, and we can just grab it from our folklore and bring it forward and repackage it.
Oh, sorry, we've lost you there.
Oh, am I still there?
No, it's the screen. Sorry.
It's just our screen.
Something's happened to the screen.
Oh.
Sorry, Andy.
No, that's okay.
We will be okay. Back.
No, it looks fine from this side.
Okay.
Perfect.
Is it gone?
I don't know.
I'm just going to keep moving so you can see that I'm okay.
There we go. We're back.
Okay.
So it's the thing as well is every culture has got the same stories, really, in every culture, isn't there? Like, obviously, Bigfoots and Loch Ness, it's like everyone's got their own version around the world.
And they seem to fall into similar categories around the world. In Beasts of the World, I talk about the weir hyena or hyena man. And that's really strange because that's still a very sort of folkloric kind of animal in parts of Ethiopia and other countries where it's often talked about. And I just thought, like, you know, wow, this is so similar, you know, to what we have in the personification of the werewolf. You know, could this be could this really just be a folkloric thing? So the hyena men there, or the weir hyenas, they um they they're actually supposed to believe to be these supernatural animals that can turn into people and into animals. So it's like it's sort of a slight difference with the way it happens.
Yeah.
And, you know, it seems to be really, really focused around certain types of people. So in Ethiopia, the Buddha or the witches are often referred to as blacksmiths as well. And many of the blacksmiths in Ethiopia originally were Jews. And they were often blamed, you know, through local superstition for any unfortunate, like, things that happened to anybody in the population. Or if, you know, darkness was falling, the mothers would sort of call their children home and say, you know, stay away from the blacksmith's house on the way home, you know. And unfortunately for the Jews in this place, because they were excluded from all the other professions, they could only be blacksmiths or woodcutters, you know. So they always ended up being the scapegoats. And I'm wondering if that superstition that we could still see in Europe, is that something that would have affected maybe also Jews, but other similar people on the fringes of society in our ancient societies as well in Europe and Britain? You know, it could have been something to do with that. You know, could that be part of it in one way? It's hard to say. You know, it's really hard to say, but it really does. That we're hiding it really does have so many, so much correlation with the werewolf legend here. Only, you know, the locals there have chosen an animal that's dangerous to them, which isn't a wolf.
Hey guys, just stepping in quickly because unfortunately at this point we did lose signal, but we sorted out the problem quickly and the show continued.
Where were we? We're so talking about
the hyena. Hyena man.
Yeah, so we're talking about hyena man, but you know, we're also talking about these other sort of cults that existed, and we were talking about cults that might have been practiced all around the world, and the way that I suppose modern societies, especially monotheistic societies, might have interpreted the other, like the Jew or the how the Catholics might have interpreted a Protestant or an Orthodox or vice versa, a Muslim, an infidel, that kind of thing. And you know, with these people, was the folklore stuck onto them? They shapeshift, you know. They think drink the blood of our children, that kind of thing. Could it be something to do with that? And there's lots and lots and lots of myths like that all around the world. Yeah. Everybody seems to have, and it's either a wolf or it's some other ravenous creature in the local environment that embodies the tradition.
Yeah. And before people could connect on social media and stuff, before the internet, everyone was having the same experiences all around the world, which I find amazing.
That's the other thing. That's the other thing, yeah. How is this, you know, is it just something natural to human nature that we've shared around the world? It's also hard when we're looking at, things we've picked up from nations that have been colonized by European countries, because essentially, in many cases, some of the stories that have been fed back to us, the Europeans, that is, who came there, seem to be reinterpretations of some European folklore, which is a funny thing, that we came, we maybe told our stories, and either their stories have been melded with our stories so we understand them, or they've just been fed back to us, you know, in a way, I suppose, to interpret some local phenomenon that we wouldn't understand otherwise, unless it's in our own, you know, picturesque vernacular. And I wonder about that a lot. You know, are we seeing, especially with little people, in fact, we go to the North America and there's like the Pukwudgie, you know, there's lots of, and the Bucks and the Pucks and lots of these different names that they have for these little things are very similar to our sort of puka and puck and, you know, Robin Goodfellow, all of these little people manifestations that we had in our culture and took over there. Yeah. I often wondered, when we got to them, did we feed them these stories And then they had similar experiences, but they fed them back to us the same way. That's my question.
Yeah. Fascinating, isn't it?
It's weird.
I've got to talk to you about my favourite cryptid, the Bigfoot.
Oh, yeah.
This is what started my whole fascination with the whole subject.
Oh, dear. Oh, look, she's saying that this is a big problem in your marriage. I can see this.
It is. I've got my little Bigfoot there.
This is the third part of our relationship.
Oh, let me see. Where is it? I missed that. Oh, there it is in the back. Oh, yeah.
My little,
that's great. Oh.
So that is what started my fascination with the cryptids. And obviously, I was listening to podcasts like Sasquatch Chronicles and things like that. And the thought that there could be Bigfoots in England, in Britain, really excites me.
I mean, it's a strange phenomenon, right? I think, you know, largely, do you know what's really, really exciting about it? I'll tell you what's exciting about the British Bigfoot question. Is there's background, right? There's background. So in our history, you know, there's the Woodwose, which is this hairy man-like creature that lives in the forest, or the Green Man even. But the Woodwose is a more direct interpretation. And it's depicted, you know, from the 12th century onwards, even before in some cases, in cloth, you know, and tapestries and the stone of our churches and all of the reliefs and the wooden carvings on the pews. It's everywhere. And you can go to churches and cathedrals all over the place and find this Woodwose depiction in churches that are, you know, close to 1,000 years old, something almost. It's there. So, you know, what were they seeing? And what did those people who depicted them think they really were? There's you probably remember there's one in the book. There's this I suppose engraving or depiction in the book of a Woodwose surrounded by dogs, and it's from the Queen Mary Psalter from 1310. You know, it's in the Royal Library collection, and it looks like a very normal creature being taunted by a bunch of hunting dogs, you know, and that it doesn't seem like an extraordinary supernatural scene. It seems like a scene in the natural world. So there's that. Where did that history come from? How did we get to that, really? Yeah. And then there's the modern sightings. There's modern sightings. And it's insane, you know, that people believe they're seeing Bigfoot, essentially, you know, in Britain, in the modern world, you know, it's and I spoke to some of them directly, and they're really passionate. Like you see when people have that experience where they keep giving you these weird mundane details in the experience because they can't, it's part of the entire experience. They can't omit it anymore.
Yeah.
You know, if their watch was broken or an alarm went off in the background, it's not really important to the sighting, but it stays there every time they tell it, comes up again and again and again. Like these great tells from, you know, sort of that PTSD sort of like framework you're in. You can't get out, and it's always there. So a lot of them, they got me convinced basically that they've definitely seen something really curious.
Could you share some of the more the craziest stories, or maybe the most believable stories?
I'll read the ones from the book because they're the ones I suppose that I put in there because they were the most believable to me. There's one you probably heard in Sasquatch Chronicles and other places, which is the Ape Man of Abernethy Forest. This one's believable to me because it was witnessed by a primate keeper of 37 years experience. So, and that was in 2012, Abernethy Forest, Strathspey, Scotland, not too far from Loch Ness, actually, as the crow flies. And you know, just to round up, he and his brother, they're wild camping in Scotland. They've got light arms, you know, guns for killing rabbits, I suppose. They want to hunt. They pop out early in the morning to hunt some rabbits, and they see a dark figure crouching with its back to them about 50 feet away. And the gentleman who reported it, because his brother didn't speak about it afterwards, said that the creature looked to be 5'2" tall, crouching down, which was his height. He's not a tall man, but that was his height. looked like it was eating berries from the bush, from the way its shoulders were moving and it was hunched over, and raised its head a little, turning slightly towards us, tilted to one side, said, listening, then stood up, turned, at the same time, looked straight at them. So it must have been 7 to 8 feet tall.
Wow.
Covered in jet black hair all over the body, except for the upper chest and face. Skin dark, except for his bottom lip, which looked pink. Wide nose, large eyes. And then he says, and this is a primate keeper speaking, features reminded me of an older bonobo chimpanzee with a flatter face, especially around the mouth, going bald on top. And wow. He said, to my eyes, I was looking at a bonobo with a much flatter muscle, but with this, you know, this upright, stocky, gorilla-like body, 4 foot across the shoulders. That was his report.
It's amazing.
And, I looked at them, you know, he said he dropped down onto one knee and put his rifle down, which, I mean, you know, it's a useless gesture anyway, you know. You'd be lucky to kill a rabbit with one of those things. And, you know, it looks back at him, turns and walks off into the tree line, looking back one last time, I suppose, to check on his, and you hear about that a lot, they check on you as they're walking away, so you're not following them. Turns around to, you know, talk to his brother, and he's gone. He's like legged him. He's left him all alone. And I know you've heard this before, but he gets back to the camp, and he's packing up. And I love this, because the way he told it, it's literally a sign of pure fear. You know, like you flee and leave your family member alone. You don't go back to check on them.
You don't see
if they're all right. And when they you know, come back unscathed, not eaten or ripped to pieces, you're already packing up, getting ready to leave.
Well,
which is great.
One together then, because that's not problem, leave yeah. me.
Yeah, I'll be gone. No,
I'll be left staring at it.
We've got to go to Scotland.
You'll be packing the bag.
Yeah, that's it.
That really is amazing.
Yeah, and it's that to me is an amazing one. It's another one close to here in Box Hill. Again, these are the two most popular sightings. I always repeat again and again, but you know, sorry for anybody that's heard them before. But that one for me is important because I've been there a bunch of times. It's an area that backs onto loads of fields and loads of countryside, but it's also near a town of Dorking. So it's a beautiful place. It's a really popular spot for walkers. This is the thing. And it's got these steps. This go up the hill. This hill's about 745 feet elevation. They've got this stone, these earthen steps with wood cut into the hillside, so wind all the way up. And you do it. Every time I do it, it kills me. I'm not very fit. It kills me. And some lunatics run it, you know, for exercise. So this lunatic, not because they saw a Bigfoot, because they're running the hill, was 2012 again, running the steps leading up to Box Hill, and heard these, you know, they later said they now believe it was wood knocks that they heard, but at the time they didn't know what they were listening to, just the sound of something knocking on trees. It's late evening, you know, it's summer, so it's still light, it's late evening. And this, you know, the runner decides they're going to sit down and have a little rest on the steps. Here's some footsteps coming down towards them, and moves to the side, thinking it must be a dog walk or something. And, you know, nobody passes, and they come back, and 10 meters behind, there's a sort of ape, you know, with brown fur, with patches of gray in it, with this like human face with a flat nose and a big jaw. She said looked out of proportion to the head, which was domed at the top, so it's got this almost conical head. Stood on two legs, so it's not, you know, it's not an escape ape from somewhere. This is a bipedal animal. Said that the arms look long in proportion to the body, which was really, really thick, built with solid muscle. Estimate of 6 or plus, looked at her for 30 seconds before turning around and walking off again, looking back and watching to make sure it knew where the witness was. And then importantly, afterwards, there's a stale animal, like farm animal type smell in the area. So you hear about this Bigfoot smell sometimes that people talk about. But she didn't smell it until it left. So it's that my theory is that that's a sort of like a that's a warning. Like, don't follow me. You know, I stink. Yeah. Whatever. You know, you're not gonna like this trail.
Yeah. It's amazing.
Yeah.
And again, everyone has the same sort of experience. Like when they're telling you the story, like, it's the same. So many people are having the same experience. Really, it's amazing.
Seems to be. It really seems to be. You know, and I
like we were saying with the big cats, with the Bigfoots, it's kind of when they are spotted, everyone's having that same common characteristic where they're just turning and walking back away from them.
Mm-hmm.
They're
not
charging, they're not. But everyone's having that same experience, turning and just kind of leaving.
Yeah. I mean, mostly there are a few bluff charges and things, but it's sort of few and far between, really. And it would seem to be largely what happens if people, I think, when people spot these animals, there's two reasons. One, they get curious about you and they come to have a look. Two, they accidentally sort of happened upon you. They're not paying attention. They're out for a walk in the woods. That's why there's so many road crossings, I think.
Mm.
You know, like animals get startled by the cars and the lights. And I think they, instead of freezing, they run across, like most animals do. They don't stop at the side of the road. When you drive up, they sort of dash across quickly, don't they?
Yeah.
Just before you get there.
Yeah,
and I think it's the same thing sometimes. Everybody out looking for them never finds a thing. Everybody sees it. It's like, I was just driving. I was walking through the woods. I never heard of anything like this before.
And they don't realize how lucky they are.
No, they don't. And they're just like, well, you know. Yeah. But if people like us out there searching, maybe, you know, got zero strikes, 0 points on the board, you know, so it's, you know.
So is there really nothing? You've never seen anything?
No. But I'm happy about that at the moment, because I think having embarked upon this journey to write these books and to look into it seriously, and I've known lots of witnesses who also became researchers and writers and the rest of it, I've got no skin in the game in a way, because I've never seen it. And so I'm not in that, oh, well, I know it's real because I've had the experience and, you know, you can't question my experience. No,
yeah,
I don't know it's real. I believe most of the witnesses I've spoken to, I'm a hopeful skeptic that really, 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 really wants it. But I'm so consumed by this sort of like psychoanalytical mulch that I've grown up with that I question like everything, every motive, every socio-cultural background to it. And that's, over the years, actually has become almost as fascinating to me as the subject itself, why we're interested. You know, this one of the things I wrote in the new book is that the age of exploration never ended. We just lost interest. You know, we just lost interest, and now we're getting that interest back. Maybe part of that was the lockdowns. And the society before that, we want to sort of dream of faraway adventures again and finding new things, because, you know, you got Google Earth, you can zoom in. It seems like everything's done, but it's not. You know, that's just like a spyglass on the forest canopy. You don't really know what's going on when you get there. And that's my interest. We're pitching actually a TV series at the moment. We're trying to get it sold. And it's this beast of the world thing. Literally, we'll go around the entire globe to every place that nobody's really been for, looking for creatures people have hardly heard of, and trying to get in there and, you know, hopefully won't get ate up or cannibalized or whatever in the forest. And, you know.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Well, I'll definitely be watching that when you get that out.
If they buy it, you know, it seems to be a process that goes on forever. They like it. They say, this is fantastic. We have to meet again in 3 months and talk about this. And, you know.
Okay. Yeah. Well, hopefully it will happen.
When it happens.
And I will certainly be watching.
Yeah. We watch My Last Moments on TV. It's, My big problem is I love wildlife, I love animals. I'm terrified of bears. I don't know why. There's no bears here. But, you know, an animal that can run as fast as a horse and climb and swim and, you know, as a sort of a unhappy temperament oftentimes towards humans. Just seems to me
not the Bigfoot, it's kind the of bears. Beast,
yeah. I'm scared of them. I see Bigfoot, werewolf even. They don't seem to be taking anybody out, but the bears, you know, the bears.
It's amazing. So tell us a bit where people can find you and where people can get your book.
Okay. Well, the best place to find me actually is just go to facebook.com/BeastsOf, or if you want to find the books are on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and every other platform, they're on there. You can get them paperback. Kindle, The Beast of Britain is an audiobook as well, actually.
Yep.
Which is it's narrated by a guy with like a clear English accent, not like my mumble fumble accent, called Jonathan Rufus Welsh. He did a really good job at like ignoring all my poor punctuation and reading, narrating it in a sensible like way. So you can find me there. There's also, I'm on, it's called Linktree. So it's like linktr.ee/BeastsOf. Everything's there, the merch, the books. If you want to book me as a speaker, I do events as well, in which I sort of don't take several cryptids or whatnot and talk about them. And I am available.
Cool. Well, I tell you what, I've read this book and it is amazing. So I recommend this book, Beast of Britain. Well, thank you, Tommy. Anyway, it's such a cool book. You've got to read it next. You're going to read it next.
On my list.
Get the audio book. It's free if you've got Audible, and then you don't have to use your eyes at all. You can just listen to it. That's how I read it.
But I'm certainly going to read the next books as well.
Yeah, thank you so much, guys.
I think, Dorset is a scary place as well, so maybe looking for an event to come and have a little...
Yeah, that'd be cool.
That would be amazing.
I'd love that.
Come down to Dorset.
Yeah, I will, have books, will travel. I'm always up for it, guys. And fantastic. Yeah, it's just, it's nice. It's just lovely to talk to nice people interested in the subject.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, right back at you.
It's been an honour to have you on the podcast, sir.
Thank you, my friend.
Absolutely fantastic.
Tree knocking outside.
Yeah, I don't know if it's Bigfoot outside.
We are in the forest.
Are you really in the middle of a forest?
We're right next to a forest.
Okay. But you're in a storm at the moment as well, so it's going to be a bit banging about. Yeah.
Don't take
Thank you. Well, listen, I think you made a great move there, Essex to Dorset, and hope you enjoy the lovely new home. Yeah, but that's catch up again when the new book comes out.
Definitely. Definitely, that would be great.
Thank you so much,
Andy. It's been an absolute honour.
Good luck with the new show, which will come out.
Yeah, and we'll be ready for that.
Watching. Ready to watch.
Thank you. Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you so much for coming on. It's so lovely to see you.
Thanks so much, Andy.
Bye.
Well, that's the show, guys. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. If you did enjoy it, please share it on your social media. That would be great. We really do appreciate that. And if you have any freaky, strange, scary stories and you'd like to come on the show, please get in touch. You can email us at letsgetfreakypodcast@outlook.com or we're on social media, TC Let's Get Freaky Podcast, and we're on Instagram, Facebook and Twitter. You can reach us on any of those platforms. So thank you so much, guys. Until next time, keep it freaky.